Hey, it's the 5th of March, right? 5th today? And we're continuing stocks. And we weren't quite finished our stock worksheet number one. So if you weren't here, anybody not here on Tuesday, get a worksheet number one because we're going to finish that up. I think I gave you one if you got here a little late. Take one. look how we're doing. Not bad, huh? Not bad at all here. 6.5%, but First Solar is our ringer. Apple's doing okay. You want to sell anything? Want to buy anything? Yes. Bye. I gave them out on Tuesday, so you probably have one. Okay. Well, we'll give them another one. Okay. This is for this class, that's it. Yeah. Okay. You want to sell anything? Want to buy anything? No? Stick with them? Not giving up on Procter & Gamble yet? All right. So let's go back to this guy. And let us, where was it? There's the stock worksheet, so we'll work on that. We didn't quite, or we rushed through it before the end of class. But we need a good joke. Who's got a good joke? No? Oh, you guys, do you really want to hear the joke? You don't have to hear it if you don't want them. I like them. Did I tell you about the alligator and the three-legged dog? No. I didn't tell you about the three-legged dog? So this three-legged dog walks into a bar, and he goes up to the bartender, and he looks him right in the eye, and he says, "I'm looking for the man who shot my paw." Because he's a three-legged dog. And he's a three-legged dog. I think bad. I told you it was bad. Okay, so let's hide this, actually. Let's hide this. And look at the, you already saw it.
That worksheet was different from mine.
That worksheet's different from yours? Okay, then you're looking at the back, probably. Yeah, you're right, because that's worksheet number two. So let's take a look at this guy. Let's look at the answer key. So good. Chapter worksheet number one. All right. We learned about the major markets, and we did not do this. We did not do the first part. But for the following stocks, name the market you believe the stock could be expected to be found on. Where do you think you'd find McDonald's? New York Stock Exchange. Yeah, no, nowhere else, right? Blue chips, been around for decades. What about Qualcomm? It's supposed to be all uppercase, by the way. What is Qualcomm? It's a stadium, right?
Yeah. No. It's the people that make the batteries in the phone.
And not anymore. They don't make the chips or the batteries anymore. They outsource that. What they do now is they keep they do make some chips. They make the Snapdragon chip now, but they don't even make that. Somebody else makes it for them. But their claim to fame is CDMA. If you have a Verizon or a Sprint phone, you use CDMA. I think it stands for can't do much anything. No, code division multiple access. If you have an AT&T phone or a T-Mobile, you use GSM, which is Nokia. And that's their big money maker. And where are they big? Yes?
I thought I just seen like in the news, like getting in trouble in Japan.
Oh, no, it's China. They were getting in trouble in China.
Okay.
I'm thinking the same one. They were attacked for doing something in China by the Chinese authorities, and I don't trust them. The Chinese authorities, you can't trust them. You can't trust the American authorities. But what?
My brother works at Qualcomm.
Your brother works at Qualcomm? What does he say about them? They treat them well, don't they? Yeah, it's a great place to work. Where would you find a high-tech company like Qualcomm?
NASDAQ.
How about the Spider ETFs? The Spider ETFs are the exchange-traded funds that mirror the Standard & Poor's. They're called Spider because of the Standard & Poor's. SPY is the symbol for Standard & Poor's 500. So they're exchange-traded funds. What? Well, we're going to put Amex, or New York Stock Exchange Market, only because that's where they started. But now they trade everywhere, everybody. So you can put anyone, or you can put everybody, or if you want a tip of the hat to where they started, that was the Amex. What about Coca-Cola? New York Stock Exchange, right? What about Butterfly.com? NASDAQ, not quite. This is where the pink sheets or the bulletin boards, You know, you've heard of butterfly.com, right? They're going to come out with blue steam. It's really cool. You're going to want to buy it, folks. So quick, it's selling for 3 cents, but if you buy it now, it'll be 30 cents in just a couple of weeks. Blue steam? Well, it's going to be better than the pink steam. Didn't work out so well. And last year, yeah, pink steam was, you know, it's supposed to fix gout or whatever. It's supposed to make your hair look better. So it didn't work too well. And they also made a left-handed smoke shifter. That didn't work out very well either. Okay. Anyway, so yeah, that's the nether. That's the wrong side of the tracks, the red light district. How about Nokia? High tech, right? No, it's on the New York Stock Exchange. Okay, so you could guess and maybe right, but you got to be sure you go online and check where it is. You would think a Nokia high tech would be on the NASDAQ, and it's actually on the New York Stock Exchange. So I didn't do that. I mean, I did that as a little bit of not that I would count it wrong or anything, but to be sure, you got to go look at the symbol and find out where it is. Now, we went through all these, didn't we?
Yeah.
Okay, great. So make sure you know those. Those are the ones I'm going to ask you to be able to identify by a description or by name. So the last thing is, you hear on the news report today or in the evening that the Dow, the Dow, and the S&P each lost 2%, but the NASDAQ gained 1% and the Russell 2000 was flat. What can you deduce from this report? Stocks were mostly unchanged. 2% drop, is that unchanged? That's a pretty big drop. Large company stocks gained, high company stock prices declined, and small companies were mostly unchanged? Or is it large company stocks lost ground, high-tech companies prices rose, and small companies were mostly unchanged? It's C. Do we know anything about foreign stocks from these four? No. From these indices, they're all domestic. Okay, so that's the kind of thing you're going to hear. All right, great. Let's continue. Now, where were we? We were at slide 57. And we had finished up the major indices, and I want you to know those. And what you're going to see every day, if you watch the nightly business report or CNBC or go online to one of the major financial websites, is you're going to see this breathtaking graph of the market zooming up in the day and then crashing in the middle of the afternoon and then finally ending up pretty much where it left off, where it started from. There's a wonderful book, folks. If you're into math, it's, you know, the numbers are all wrong because it was written in the early 1950s, but it's called How to Lie with Statistics. And it's a lot of fun, and I know you millennials don't like books, but it's a lot of fun. One of them yesterday in the other class said, well, only book I read was boring. I said, well, you're reading the wrong books, because books are a whole lot better than the movies, certainly. And in that book, they describe one of the ways that people lie with statistics. This is a lie. Was the market really that volatile? No. Because if they would have included from 0 to 17,905, the graph would look a whole lot different, right? Let's see what would happen if they were in. See, it's today's unstable stock market. Look what happened. And if we include the whole, it looks a whole lot different, doesn't it? See, it doesn't look like it changed at all. But you think you're going to see this graph on the news? No. Would that graph sell any newspapers, sell any magazines, sell any advertising on the television? No. So you're not going to see today's stable stock market. And if you remember, on our first presentation, we showed you volatility. Remember? We showed you what happened with the S&P 500 in 2014. How it, you know, dipped, you know, $500 if you put $10,000 in, and then roared back and then dipped again and came back and then dipped and dipped. But if we include the entire $0 to $10,000, it doesn't look as exciting, does it? Are you going to see this graph on the news? No. So should we be that concerned about volatility? Is it something that really should scare us? No. In fact, the professionals look at it as an opportunity. Betsy, would you hit the lights? This is a video, and I'm not going to show just a couple of minutes, not even a couple of minutes of it. And It was at 448, right? I should have gotten myself there. And this is a guy who's been in the business for 44 years, okay? That, you think that's enough there? 44 years? And he's being asked, this is actually was recorded in December 2014, and it's a year ahead. They, every year they do it a year ahead. American Funds isn't the only one who does that. Lots of companies do it. But this guy's from American Funds. So let's see if we can get this going here.
If you think about the volatility that we experienced just a few months ago, it's a question at the forefront of everyone's mind. How should we think about volatility going forward?
Well, I think we're going to see volatility ebb and flow. I think trying to predict volatility is about as profitable an exercise as trying to predict short-term interest rates and movements. It's very difficult. People get excited about something and the market gets a bit volatile for a period of time, then it seems to settle down again. So I've spent so much time thinking out in 3 and 4 and 5 year time frames that if the market goes down, as I've said to you many times, I sort of look at that as a positive because I get to buy things less expensively, and for most of the time, that's what I think about when I think about volatility. It's an opportunity to buy things that I feel are attractive. Nonetheless, I wouldn't be surprised to see a few glitches here and there along the way. We still have a very dysfunctional government in the United States with the Republicans feeling their oats and Obama doing what he's doing, and we'll see if there's any ability to get some agreement on things. So I think we'll see bits and pieces of volatility throughout the year.
So in other words, welcome volatility. The market falls 5-10%, great! Unless the world ends, in which case it doesn't really matter. And this guy's been in the business for 44 years, so he's seen a lot of volatility. Any questions? Any thoughts? And in a couple of weeks, folks, and starting next week, we'll see what he was talking about when he said 3, 4, 5 years ahead. How can you look 3 or 4 or 5 years ahead? Well, it's not easy, but that's what good professionals do. They don't look at what's going to happen in the next 3 weeks because it's impossible. It is absolutely impossible. Okay, so we want to hit the lights again, Betsy again? Okay, so now what we're going to do is we want to get to slide 683 by the end of the day. I don't know if we will or not, but we'll see. Because we want to take a look at common stock characteristics. And I know some of this stuff is not really exciting. It's kind of boring. But it's important. You have to know it. Stock spin-offs. Companies from time to time will spin off parts of themselves. They will convert one of their subsidiaries to a standalone company by distribution of stock in that new company to existing shareholders. Sometimes the new company is still majority owned by the company that spun it off. And one good example was Altria, Philip Morris. They owned Miller Beer, they owned Post Cereal, they owned Kraft, Nabisco, Oscar Mayer. I mean, they just owned all these companies. And many people would not invest in them because they sell cigarettes. So they go, oh, what the hell are we going to do? So what they did is they spun off Kraft. They still own a ton of the stock. They still own a bunch of it. But the world's second largest food company is Kraft until Kraft split itself up a couple years ago into the food company and then the snack company. Do you know who makes Oreos now? You know the name of the company? They don't care if you know. What? Yeah, well, Nabisco is owned by this company. It's Mondelez. You knew that, didn't you? No, they don't care. They don't care that you know that name. They want you to know Oreos, right? Triscuits. So they then divested themselves of the international tobacco business. So that's a whole different company. That's one of the ones we follow. Philip Morris International, based here in the United States, but they don't sell a thing in the United States. They sell everything outside the United States. The history of spinoffs have been checkered. The history has been checkered. I'm sorry. Some spinoffs have done better than the companies that spun them off. Examples of this are the Baby Bells. Now, most of you weren't around, but in 1984, AT&T was split up into AT&T, the company, that was the long distance, and they still owned Bell Labs and Western Electric. And then all the independent, well, now they were independent, all the different monopolies, all the different local phone companies. And AT&T, because they were in the long distance business, that started going down and down and down and down, because that just, that technology just kept making that cheaper and cheaper and cheaper. And the local monopolies just kept raising their prices, and then started swallowing one another. Bell Atlantic started swallowing a bunch of ones in the north, and that's now Verizon. And SBC Communications, based in Houston, I think, or Dallas, someplace, they swallowed Bell South and Pacific Telephone and who was the one up in the Pacific Northwest. And they then swallowed AT&T, and now they're AT&T, the new AT&T. You understand? So some spinoffs do really well. In fact, 7-Eleven, the Southland Corporation, they, this is real interesting. 7-Eleven, I don't know if you've noticed 7-Eleven, but they've changed quite a bit. I don't know if you've noticed. They're very different when you go in there now. And what happened is they opened up they started a Japanese 7-Eleven. And it was a separate company and traded in Japan, but you could buy the shares here. That company exploded, because in Japan, that's the way they do business. So that company exploded, turned around and bought the United States 7-Eleven. So the 7-Eleven in the United States is now owned by the Japanese 7-Eleven. But some spinoffs have not done so well. AT&T spun off their Bell Labs and Western Electric. That was the company that made the telephone equipment. And now it's called Lucent Technologies. And they made some, not that they don't make very good telephone equipment. Yeah, they still make the best telephone equipment in the world. But they made some really stupid mistakes that we'll see later on. And Coca-Cola Enterprises didn't do well. I think Coca-Cola was talking about actually buying them back. Coca-Cola is the company that makes the syrup, makes the soda. Coca-Cola Enterprises bottles the syrup. They bottle it and turn it into the stuff you drink. So that didn't do so well. Questions? Thoughts? Yes. He used to work for Lucent Technologies, and did he get some kind of great severance pay when they went through a near death experience? He bailed. Oh, good. Smart man. He bailed. Probably cashed out all his shares. Good man. Now, a stock split. A stock split is a maneuver in which a company increases the number of shares outstanding by exchanging a specified number of new shares for each outstanding shares. You'll hear of a 2-for-1 split, or a 3-for-1, or a 5-for-1, or a 1-for-5. You know, they'll do a reverse split. So, 2-for-1 split. You had 100 shares. You now have 200 shares. Yippee! Aren't you excited? No. Because what happened to the price? It went down in half. Right? There is no increased value from a stock split. None whatsoever. If you had one share at $20, you now have two shares at $10. Nowadays, it's a psychological increase. People get excited about having more shares. Companies used to split their stock because it just made trading 100 share increments easier. And that was the technology. People wanted to trade 100 share increments. But that's gone away now. So there's no reason anymore to split a stock. Sometimes I think, and they won't tell you because they're not allowed to, that's what the lawyers are telling them to do, a company will split their shares when they think it looks good. They're trying to tell the world, we think things are looking good, without saying. We think things are looking good, because if things don't turn out, they'll get sued. Some companies refuse. From the 1960s, Warren Buffett, who was, until this year, you know, he was every once in a while, he's the world's richest man, and now Bill Gates, of Berkshire Hathaway, has refused to split his stock since the 1960s. A single share goes for over $225,000. If you bought one share, you know, $60 or whatever it was in 1960, whatever, is now worth $225,000. But folks, if Coca-Cola had never split, or Walmart, or GE had never split their shares, that's how much they'd be worth, hundreds of thousands, if not millions. There's a wonderful story of a woman who started working for Abbott Labs. Now, you've probably never heard of them, but they're a pretty big company, and whenever you have blood taken, there's a good chance that they're the ones who are checking it out. And she started working there as a young woman, and worked there until 83 when she passed away. She bought 3 shares, and they were worth $1.3 million when she passed away. Never cashed them in. That's the kind yeah? Now, what happens? What happens when there's a 1 for 5? Why would they take 5 or 10 of your shares and give you 1? They're trying to raise the price. And there's a reason for that. That when they try to raise the price, because if the price goes too low, the New York Stock Exchange or the NASDAQ will kick them out. So they have to do a reverse split to raise the price back up. Because they're giving you 1 share when you had 10, so the price increases by a factor of 10. Make sense? Am I going too fast? Yes.
Then how, why is it a big deal? Like when Qualcomm split, all these millionaires were there.
Well, no, but no, they didn't. When Qualcomm split a few years ago, that's a good example. Qualcomm split their stock a few years ago, and to my mind, because I was following at the time, it looked as though they were trying to say things looked pretty rosy. And it turned out they were right. The stock did very well. But they got to be careful. You might, when you do the assignment for Chapter 5, I'm going to ask you to do a couple of, actually, we should do 3. Earnings calls. And there are going to be in the earnings calls forward-looking statements. What the hell does that mean? Forward-looking statements. It's tough, folks. For anticipation, what's going to happen in the future. See, they got to be careful. Because if they say, you know what, things look really great, and then next year doesn't work out so well, the lawyers... There's a reason there are lawyer jokes. Have you heard good lawyer jokes? Anybody got any good lawyer jokes? What do you know when you see 3 lawyers buried up to their necks in concrete? You see 3 lawyers buried up to their necks in concrete, what do you know? They ran out of concrete. But, you know, before lawyers, it was pistols at dawn. So yes, we hate the lawyers, but we like the lawyers. And that's why they split the stock. They split this, Qualcomm split the stock, because they were trying to tell people, hey, we think things are doing well, but we don't want to say that and get sued later on if things don't go so well because China has kicked us in the butt. Make sense?
So that's basically when they decide to either split or not by trying to forecast.
That's what I think it is now. Because there's no technological reason for them to split the stock anymore. That's gone. There's no people on the floor of the exchange yelling out, 25, you know, I'll buy 100 shares at 25. It's all electronic, so you don't care what the price of the stock is. Whether you buy 1 or 100 shares or 17 shares, it's not important. Make sense?
Yeah. Who decides that?
The board of directors. The board of directors, the CEO, get together and say, hey, let's split the shares. But there's no increased value. Okay, how are we doing? Not too good. Okay, treasury stock. Got to get a little faster. Yes? To look into the future.
Yeah, but you're saying they don't do it very often.
Well, when they do, they say, look, you know, this is a forward-looking statement, and it may or may not turn out the way we think it's going to turn out. Please don't sue us. you're going to do earnings calls. You're going to hear them talk about, well, you know, this is, they'll say, I mean, the lawyers told them to say it. This is our opinion as of this date. Our opinion may change tomorrow because the world changes tomorrow. They don't say it like that, but they'll say something like, you know, this on this date, this is what we thought, and we reserve the right to change our opinion at any time. Okay, now let's continue. Treasury stock. Shares of stock that have been sold and subsequently repurchased by the issuing firm. They're called share buybacks. Now, you students of economics, you saw the supply-demand curve, right? If the supply is reduced and the demand doesn't change, what should happen to the price? It should go up, right. And that's the idea. The logic is that after the buyback, there is less supply. Existing shareholders now have a larger percentage ownership of the company. And so if the demand doesn't change, the price should go up. Some companies are very aggressive in buying back their stock. And remember the video? The second day of the crash, all these companies went in there and started buying back their stock. They were smart. They said, hey, it dropped 30% in a couple of days. Get in there and buy some shares. It's a good time to buy. During the run-up of the 1990s, share buybacks were often seen as a better alternative to dividend increases. The belief was that investors were more interested in capital gains and then the company returning the money in the form of dividends, and that buybacks increased the potential for capital gains by reducing the supply of stocks. There are several companies now that are aggressively buying back their shares. You need to look at that company and say, okay, am I more interested in capital gains or am I more interested in the money being returned to me in the form of dividends? I like it when companies buy back their shares after a crash. When the market's going up and up and up and up and they're buying back their shares, I'm going, all right, why are they doing that? But they might still think that their shares are a good value. But once those shares are bought back, they are no longer traded. They are now... they're gone into the treasury, it's called. The treasury stock, and they no longer trade anymore. They have been removed from the marketplace. Classifications of common stocks. Different companies will have different classifications. At one time, I think GM had 7 different classes, A through H or whatever. For example, Berkshire Hathaway. The A shares are the original shares, and they're selling for $225,000. In the mid-1990s, the financial world pressed Warren Buffett to offer a lower-cost version of his stock. He didn't want to do it, but they said, "Look, you know, we need you to be we want to be able to offer your shares at a lower price." So he relented. There's a history of that. I got the link on there. It's a little bit more complicated than how I'm describing it. But so he said, "All right, I'll put out a lower-cost one." He put out a Class B at $1,000, $1,100. That's not what they had in mind. They were looking for something like $80, $100, and he went, yeah, yeah. And in the prospectus, he said he wouldn't buy them. He said, he's a very ornery guy. He's like, normally when the company is putting out a prospectus because they're issuing shares, they're trying their best to get people to buy them. Come on, buy our shares, we're doing great. Yeah, they don't say it like that, but that's what they're trying to do. And he's saying there, yeah, yeah, I don't want you to even buy my shares. I wouldn't buy them. Well, then, you see, I know, but then he turned around and he came, you know, this is a pretty good deal. The B shares then became a way for him to buy other companies. So he did a split 50-for-1 a couple of years ago, and now they sell for about $150, and now he uses them like cash. He uses them to buy different companies. Often, there'll be the A shares for everybody, and the B shares will be reserved for the family, the people who the heirs of the person who started the company or persons who started the company. And the B shares will pay a rich dividend, and the A shares will be the ones that have voting rights, and the B shares are just there for the people who are making money. Making sense? Yeah. So if you look up Berkshire Hathaway, you look up Berk A and then Berk B. Berk A is the one that's $230,000, whatever it is, and Berk B is the one for $150,000. Now, par value. I've never really figured this one out, but it's a stated value that they put on the stock. It's often a dollar or a 1 cent per share. I don't know what it means, but it's there. The book value is far more important. This is one of the things I ask you to look up in Chapter 5, along with the market value. And the book value for you accounting fans is the assets on the books minus all the liabilities. Right? So, does that sound familiar? Assets minus liabilities, in accounting we call it equity. In the personal finance class we call it net worth. But what they're going to do, and I'll show you, because this is the trickiest one. This is the trickiest one to find. If we go back to the, where are we? Yahoo. Let's take a look at Caterpillar. If we look at Caterpillar, all the things that we're looking up on the assignment sheet, dividend yield, PE, earnings per share, market cap, they're all here. But the book value is under key statistics. So let me show you the book. So what's the price of Caterpillar? $880. If we look up key statistics, and some of these numbers we'll look up later on, some of them we won't. But right here, here's the book value, $27.63. This is what the accountants have on the books. They have on their books assets worth a certain amount minus liabilities, and that number is $27.63. So if you were to sell Caterpillar, sell off all the assets, liquidate the company, pay off all the debts, you'd have $27.63. But wait a minute, what's it selling for? Almost $81. Does it make sense to liquidate Caterpillar, sell off all the assets, and pay off all the debts and walk away? No. And in fact, what investors are saying, and this makes sense when you think about it, is that the company intact is worth far more than what's on the books. And think about a shoe shop or a pizza shop. Isn't that make sense? I mean, how much does a pizza shop work? You got the pots and the pans and the tables, and maybe the pizza oven's worth a lot. But the company itself intact is worth more than if you were to sell off all the assets and pay off all the debts and walk away. Now, there are times when certain companies, for whatever reasons, the book value and the market value diverge. The market value goes below the book value. And when that happens, there's a real danger there of people called corporate raiders, private equity entrepreneurs. They go by various names. Mitt Romney. He worked for Bain Capital, which was a corporate raider, a private equity firm. And they come in, all they got to do is buy 50% plus one share, and then they control the company, and they can vote to have the company liquidated. They will liquidate the assets, pay off all the debts, you got to pay off the debts, and walk away with money in their pocket. Now, that company's out of business, you worked for them for 22 years, how would you feel? You'd feel like crap, right? And you'd be pretty angry at this thing called capitalism, and you'd say, I don't want this stuff happening for me. But what would the economist, well, the folks at the private equity firm won't even talk to you. They got a private jet to get on. But what would the economics professors tell you? Or the finance professors? What was wrong with that company? It was time for them to die. Companies go through a lifespan like humans, and it was time for that capital to be unlocked, I don't know if this makes sense. Think of it as being dug up and buried, like the crops. It was time for that soil to be retilled, because that capital was locked in an unprofitable, unproductive method, and so it was time for it to be. And that's why. I mean, some of you might have heard this before. I could tell it in the 1.1 point. That's why we have unemployment, folks. We don't have unemployment to not pay to people, pay people not to work. We want that to happen. We want that firm to be dug up and that capital be redistributed and go someplace else. And we want that human capital to be unlocked. But at the same time, we want people to eat. Right? We want to have that safety net. And you'll hear people say, oh, why do we have unemployment? We're paying people not to work. No, that's not the reason. Now, to some people, nothing's perfect. Do some people exploit the system? Oh, I'm sure. Sure. Yeah, I'm sure you do get people to do that. But I would submit that it's few and far between. Most people I know want to have a job. Right? They want to have a job. They're not interested in but I have an example. My buddy from high school worked at Bayer. You heard of Bayer?
Yeah.
Yeah, Bayer Aspirin. You heard of Bayer? Well, he wasn't working at Bayer Aspirin. He was working at Bayer, but he was working at chemical. And he worked there, I think it was 27 years. And then they finally closed the plant and laid everybody off. And they gave him, a whole year's worth of salary as a severance pay. And it was the first time he hadn't worked in years. And his brother, who's a bit of a jerk, was going, why aren't you looking for a job? Why aren't you looking for a job? Because I might find one. I like this. You know, I haven't worked. He's back though. That was a few years ago. He's back to working, but he's just, I like this. Yeah, no, they treated them well. They did treat them well. Okay, questions, thoughts? Are we going fast enough? I don't know. Okay, now, dividends. Do we like dividends? Oh, yes. These are shares of earnings that are given to stockholders, normally paid quarterly. In the United States and in countries that had something to do in the past with the United Kingdom, Canada, South Africa, Australia, Hong Kong, they pay dividends. We pay dividends quarterly. Outside those companies, they pay them semi-annually, sometimes annually. But in the United States, the tradition is to pay every quarter. The board of directors decides how much, if any, dividends should be paid and when they will pay them. The dividends are usually a percentage of the earnings per share. The earnings per share are very important. That is the amount of annual earnings available to common shareholders as stated on a per share basis. And you will hear people say, how are their earnings doing? Oh, they're growing. That's great. So here's an example. This company reports $1 million in earnings. Now, is that a lot of money? $1 million? Well, to you and me, it's a lot of money, but maybe to a company, it's you know, chump change. We have to know how many shares are outstanding. There are 500,000 shares. So they have $1 million of earnings, and they have 500,000 shares. So we take the earnings per share, and that gives us $2 per share. Make sense? Okay, so you'll see $2, oops, not 200, EPS, earnings per share. The board of directors might decide to pay out 50% of their earnings per share in the form of dividends. Therefore, each shareholder would receive $1 dividend for each share they own. Now, they used to send you a check. They don't do that anymore. I mean, you can. You can tell them to send you a check. They'll look at you funny. They might even charge you for it. But they want everything to go into your account automatically, electronically. This is called the dividend payout ratio. The company is paying out 50% of their earnings to the shareholders in the form of dividends. Got that? Okay. So now, the very important dividend yield. This is a measure that relates the dividends to share price and puts stock dividends on a relative percentage basis rather than an absolute dollar basis. Sure, it's great for us to know we're getting a dollar, but how much is that as a percentage of the stock? And what this stock price. If the stock in the previous slide that we're paying a dollar dividend were selling for $20, we'd take a dollar divided by 20, and we get 5.05 or 5%. And traditionally, 3, 4, 5, 6% was normal. In the 1990s, dividends went down to 2%, and then eventually at the peak in March of 2000, dividends were 1% for the Standard & Poor's 500. Dividends went above 3%, if you remember the little graph we saw a couple week ago. And then they have gone back down now to about 2%. So the S&P 500 is now paying 2%, about that. But some companies are paying a lot more, and some companies are not paying anything. Okay, so let's now take a look at worksheet number two, right? On the back of the first worksheet, where are my copies? Everybody one of those decades? Everybody got worksheet number one? I must have passed them all out. This is chapter 6. Why did I even bring this with me? Here they are. You got, who's got, look on the back of worksheet number 1. Look on the back of worksheet number 1. We'll take a worksheet number 2. Okay, good. There you go. Okay. So we have some, let's not do these right now. Let's skip 1 through 6.
I don't have it.
You don't have it? Okay. So, I got these in weird order. Widget, look at the bottom. Widgets Incorporated is selling for $50. Okay, so that's the market price. We go online, we're going to do 17 and 18. I got it all backwards here. Widgets is selling for, what are widgets, by the way? Yeah, thingamabobs, chuchkas, anything you want them to be. Widgets is selling for $50, so that's the market price. And last year, the earnings per share were $3.50. The accountants told us that. And the dividend is $2. The board of directors says we'll pay out per share $2. So 17, what is the dividend payout ratio? Who wants to pull this one off, huh? Dividend payout ratio? Yeah, that's why I think I'm going too fast. The dividend payout ratio. Yes, Miguel. No, is it Miguel?
Jacob,
yeah. $2. That's the dividend yield. That's the next one. It's $2 over the earnings per share. See, that makes me feel like I'm losing you here. Dividend divided by the earnings per share is the dividend payout ratio. Because they're earning $3.50. Now, what can they do with that money? They can sit on it. You accountants, if they don't pay it out in dividends, you remember what it's called? You don't have to. Retained earnings. Remember now? Don't you just hate accounting? I don't blame you. You don't need to know accounting to be a good investor. But the more accounting you know, the better the investor you'll be, folks. Because really, that's the language of business, is accounting. And I am so happy we have Maria Martinez here. Have you taken her? How many students love their accounting instructors? Think about that. She's beloved by her students. How many accounting professors have you found who are loved by their students? Not too many, okay? So that's the dividend payout ratio. You take the dividends divided by how much you're earning. And so what is that? 0.5714? Yeah, so about 57%. Everybody see that? Nod your head yes? Or am I going too fast? I'm trying to get through, but I don't want to go through too fast at the expense of not learning. We want to learn what we're doing. Questions, thoughts? Everybody know? Where did I lose you? What did I do? Where did I first lose control? So the company is paying out $2 in dividends. That means every person who owns a share is going to get $2 every year. And they're earning $3.50, so they're paying 57% of their dividend, of their earnings, out in the form of dividends. That's the dividend payout ratio. And you will find that it's on the low side for companies that are growing, and on the higher side for companies that are not growing, that are mature companies. Why? Because they don't need to reinvest the dividends, the earnings, back into the company. So they can pay out a higher percentage of dividends. Make sense? Okay, next one. That was number 17. Now number 18. Who answered me? And I hit him hard. Who was that? Who did it? Because you did it the right way first. Who was it? Yes, I'm sorry.
Isn't that for the dividend yield?
Right, the dividend yield is the dividends. Who was it? It was you, right?
Yeah.
Like Jacob. So $2 divided by?
$50.
Did I reverse them? Did I screw up? Where am I? Ask me if I know what I'm doing. No, dividend yield is number 18. Right, number 18. So the dividend yield is the dividends. You can't spell. Dividends divided by the market price. So if they're giving you a dollar, $2 every year, and you have to pay $50 for that, what is the dividend yield? 0.04 or 4%, which is pretty darn healthy yield these days. 3% is good. 4% is great. Questions? Thoughts? It's really quiet. When it's really quiet, I think I'm screwing up. Or else you're too terrified to ask me a question. Or it's too boring. This is boring, Glenn. This is boring. You don't get excited about dividends? I get excited about dividends. Okay, now, some important dates. There's a day on which the board of directors will declare the dividend. So on a such and such date, they're declaring a dividend. But they give you a few weeks to actually buy the stock or sell the stock if you don't want the dividend. So there's a date of record on which the investor must be a registered shareholder of the firm to be entitled to that dividend. Hey, I want some of that dividend. Were you a registered shareholder? Yeah, I bought the shares before that date. But here's the tricky part. 3 business days before that date of record, you have to buy those shares. Because that's ex-dividend date. Huh? Hang on a minute. And then they don't pay it for another few weeks. That's the payment date. You won't see it in your account for another few weeks. Why is the ex-dividend date 3 days before the date of record? Because stock transactions close in 3 days. Mutual fund transactions close in 1 day. Unless it's an ETF, then it's like these guys. But you buy a mutual fund, you don't really get the shares until the next day. Or if you sell the mutual funds, you don't get the money until the next day. Stock dividend, stock transactions closing, and bonds one day. Bonds going one day. But stocks close in 3 days. So if you purchase the stock on June 15th, you don't only get the stock until June 18th. Theoretically, this is theoretically because the market's always moving, the opening share price on the ex-dividend date should reflect a drop in price commensurate with the amount of the dividend. So if there's a $1 per share dividend, the opening stock price should be reduced by a dollar. Does it ever work that way? No, because the prices are moving all over the place. So this ex-dividend date to me is something, I mean, I guess if you're buying 100,000 shares, it's important. But if you're buying 10 shares, who cares? But what you will hear in the industry is don't buy the dividend. It's a common saying. The translation is you're better off waiting until the ex-dividend date before buying the stock. Here's the reasoning. Dividends are taxable transactions. If you buy the dividend, you buy the stock just before the ex-dividend date, you will be responsible for paying the tax on the dividend, and presumably the stock price will fall commensurate, you know what that means, along with the amount of the dividend. So you are better off waiting until after the ex-dividend date so that you'll get the stock at a better price and not generate a taxable transaction. And the way I look at it, I'd say, big deal. How much are we buying? 10 shares. Now, if you're buying 10,000 or 100,000 shares, I guess that is a big deal. Yes, George?
So is the dividend the same thing as capital gains?
No. Capital gains and dividends are different. Dividends are when the company says, hey, we earned $2 a share. Here's a dollar of that. And it goes in your pocket. And they used to cut you a check, but they don't do that anymore. It's all electronic. Capital gains are when you bought the shares for $20 and then you sold them for $40 or $100. That's a capital gain. You understand? No? Yeah? That's when you buy something and then sell it for more. And if you bought it and sold it for less, capital loss. So dividends are distributions of earnings. It's an accounting transaction. And the corporation says, we paid a dollar to each and every one of our shareholders, and you're going to get a 1099. Whereas a capital gain, what they're going to do is they're going to say, hey, a good brokerage will keep track of this. In fact, all brokerages now are supposed to. But some of them didn't. You were supposed to keep track of it. I bought it for 10. I sold it for 20. I have to pay capital gains on the difference. Capital gains taxes on the difference. Make sense? There are two different things. That's a good. Maybe I should make that point a little bit harsher. harsher. But do you understand what I'm saying, folks? Don't buy the dividend. Now, there's a caveat here. If you're about to put a ton of money into a mutual fund, one of the worst times to do it is December 1st or December 2nd. Because that's when the mutual funds will distribute their capital gains and their dividends. So you want to wait. You want to look. If that's you, which is not most of you, not me mostly, you wait until after, because then you could wind up with a hefty, it won't be that much. But some people get really upset, especially if maybe they got an inheritance and this was their $100,000 they put in November 30th, and then December 3rd they distribute the dividends, and now they have a $3,000 tax bill or something like that. And so, okay. So there are types of not, boy, folks, you have to understand this because this is important. And hopefully if you deal with the kind of stocks we talk about in this class, you won't have this problem. But there are two forms of dividends. There are cash dividends, and that's what you want. And if you don't remember anything else, just know, give me the cash. Show me the cash. And then there are stock dividends. Huh? Well, instead of paying you cash, what they do is they give you more shares. So they dilute the shares like a stock split. If they give you a 10% stock dividend, that means the price of the shares should fall 10% because it's like a stock split. It's like giving you 100% stock dividend. Well, that's what a stock split is, 2-for-1. They give you 2 shares for every 1 share you have. So do you want stock dividends? No. Unlike a cash dividend, though, a stock dividend is not taxed. Wasn't that nice? Thank you very much, IRS. for not taxing me on something that's worthless. The cash dividends are taxable, but they are taxable at a pretty advantageous rate these days, thanks to George Bush. Now, here's where we get a little wrinkle. Most good companies, big companies, I shouldn't use the word good, most large cap companies, and you can, and most brokerage firms now allow you to do it, you can get what's called a dividend reinvestment plan. Isn't that called DRIP? Isn't that what you want, a DRIP? Yeah, DRIPs are cool. DRIPs are plans in which shareholders have the cash dividends automatically reinvested back into shares. Now, these are not stock dividends, folks. These are cash dividends. These are taxable transactions. But what the company did, and they don't do it. They have somebody do it for them. What the company did is they went out and bought more of their shares and gave them to you. So they didn't issue new shares to do the stock dividend. They gave you the cash, and with that cash, they bought more of their own shares, and it went into your account. So it is a taxable transaction, and they are cool. Why? Because DRIPs are an excellent way to own stock for those interested in long-term growth and not interested in current income. So you're not interested in using the dividends to live off of, and you're not to buy and sell for capital gains. It allows the investor to take advantage of compounding automatically with normally or very, very small transaction costs. Investing in a company like GE or Johnson & Johnson, it's like investing in a mutual fund because these companies are multinational and they have multiple divisions. And so I'm going to show you a DRIP from a little partnership I belong to. And where is it? See, this is the problem with this guy. There it is. There's the DRIP. And this was an investment partnership that we had here on campus, and we called ourselves Cockatoo Grove Investments. Do you know what Cockatoo Grove is? You're sitting on it. Before Southwestern was Southwestern, it was called Cockatoo Grove. This area of Chula Vista is called Cockatoo Grove. I thought that was cute. That's why we came up with the name. Anyway, and so there I am, and he was the president. I was the treasurer. And so we were buying shares, or we bought shares in Sempra. That's SDG&E. And you go to Sempra, and you go on their website, and you do investor relations, and yeah, they have a DRIP. And they didn't take care of it. This company called Equiserve did it for them. And they would charge us every once in a while. Where was it? Where was the fee? Here, the fee. They charge us 9 cents every once in a while, or 6 cents. Because that's how much it cost them to operate it. Because Sempra was trying to encourage shareholders to buy their shares, right? They want people to buy their shares. And they know that people who are interested in DRIPs are long-term investors. So they would simply charge us what it cost them to run it. And I assume that Sempra didn't make a dime, and it was this company who was actually making the money. So what you see here is the balance of shares, 36.099, because you wind up getting thousands of shares, like a mutual fund. And this day, January 15, 2003, they declared a dividend, and on those 36.099 shares, we got $9.02. And with that $9.02, they went out and bought at the share price of $24.53, they bought for us 0.368 shares, and now we have 36.467 shares. Understand? And notice that the next quarter, January, April, July, October, that's every 3 months, we bought $9.02 worth. So it's compounding. Okay, 8 cents, big deal, 10 cents. But that over time, it is a big deal. And so at a price of, the price went up, $26.23, we got 0.348 shares, and now we have 36.81 shares. You see it? Very cool. I like DRIPs. Now what's the downside? 18 different companies, you get 18 different statements. So it's a bit of an accounting mess. But some companies will allow you to put all your DRIPs in one place and maybe charge you $10 a month or something like that. And some of the brokerage firms now, they'll do it as part of your brokerage. They'll say, okay, we'll do it, no problem, we'll charge you.
Do all companies have
DRIPs? No, not all, but most of the big, large cap companies will, you go on their website, you pick investor relations, and they will have a link for dividend reinvestment plans. Is SDG&E going to go anywhere?
Nope.
Are people all of a sudden decide they're going to take cold showers in the dark?
But it depends with all this stuff, with the solar stuff going on.
Well, they, you know, that's an issue. Well, that's an issue, you wonder about them. They haven't been the most friendly towards solar, but at the same time, we have solar panels. We haven't had any problems with them. They just want to make sure there are regulations, because their guys and gals can get electrocuted if the lights go off in a certain area and your solar panels are still producing. Then somebody can get electrocuted. And so your inverter automatically shuts down. Plus, they also have, and you have to leave it there. They have to have access to it. They have a switch. They come around and they shut off your electricity. It's a double, you know, they're into double security. And the guys and gals out in the field, they have these little computers, these Panasonics. Because the guy next to me is the engineer who put it all together. And it shows every single house and every single building, every single business that has solar panels. So, you know, they're not that friendly, but they're not that unfriendly. Do you think we'll ever have... We have a tremendous... Let's not get on solar. We have a tremendous opportunity here in the Southern California to get enough people to have solar panels that it would just be awesome. We'd be the envy of the country. And we could do it. But let's not get on that kind of discussion. Did I answer your question, George?
Yes.
Okay, good. Okay, I got to be careful. I could talk about this a lot longer than most people would ever want to listen. How are we doing over time? Not bad. P.E., price to earnings ratio. Folks, this is it, folks. This is the most popular market statistic. What is the price to earnings? And it is subtle. It is subtle, but it is actually a very straightforward calculation. And you don't have to do it because it's always on every website you look at. But it's very simple. You just take the price, the market price, and you divide it by the earnings per share. And you'll see it P/E. You'll see PE by itself. In the previous example, if we had a $20 stock price, the stock price was $20, and we were earning $2 per share, EPS, so the market price is, the market price is $2, and the, $20, and the earnings per share are $2, you would have a PE of 10. Now, don't put a percent sign. Don't put a dollar sign, all right? It is unitless. But a lot of people will put the percent sign. It's not right. Traditionally, stocks sold for a P.E. ratio of about 5 to 14. A P.E. ratio of 20 or more was only reserved for the fastest-growing companies. But different times, late 1920s or late 1960s, and then certainly the 1980s and the end of the 1990s, P.E.s of 20 were just, that was commonplace, 40, 50, 80, 100. P.E.s came down greatly. Why? Because the prices came down greatly. We will spend a great deal of time learning about PE and the interaction of PE and investors' expectations as we go forward. So before we do that, though, let's do number 16. So look at worksheet number 2, and let's do number 16. I'm sorry? Well, let's do it. Okay, let's read it. Widgets. What is the market price? 20 is the market. No, for widgets. Widgets. $50. And what's the earnings per share? $3.50. So is David right? 14.29? Is that right? Is that high? Not really. No, it's pretty low, actually, by today's standards. But it's about average. 14 is about average. And now maybe you might remember when we were looking at some of the companies, we were looking at the PEs. Remember the PEs? And you're going, what's he talking about? I don't know. We want to take a look at some of our PEs of some of our companies? Let's go back to our website here. And where is it here? It's Caterpillar. Caterpillar's PE. 13.8. not that high. And so what does it mean? It means investor expectations are not that excited. They're not that excited about the prospects for Caterpillar. Because the higher the PE, the higher the expectations of investors. Because they have bid up the price relative to the earnings. So who else are we looking at, huh? Who else did we look at? First Solar, FSLR, right? I remember that. FSLR, and what's their PE? Reasonable, not that bad, actually, 15.73. So even though the stock has done really well, investors are still have not bid up the price very high relative to the company's earnings. So why don't we look at Farsbook now? Okay, who's that? What's the fleets book? What is... Yeah, wow. A few months ago, it was over 100. Yeah. So what are investors saying about fleets book? They really believe that Facebook is going to, you know, shoot the lights out and do really, really well. And if they do... Yippee! And if they don't, the parachutes had better be pretty large. Because to get back down to a PE of about 15, 16, the price would have to fall by a factor of 3 or 4, wouldn't it? Have to fall by a factor of 4.
So based on that, would you like to buy it?
Would I buy Farsbook? I don't think so. Look, do they pay any dividends?
No.
Do I like dividends? So would I buy Farsbook? Probably not. But would you buy Farsbook? That's why there's chocolate and vanilla and some people like strawberry. Okay. Are you with me? I'm not trying to tell you not to buy Facebook. What I'm trying to get you to do is to understand what you're doing when you buy Facebook. Or when you don't buy Facebook. Yeah, when you don't buy Facebook. Oh, watch. It was a roller coaster. It came out at, I think, 38. Let's take a look at the interactive. This is not as good as the old one, but it's better. At least Yahoo will tell you that, but it's horrible. And it crashes all the time. It came out at about 38. Yeah, actually, the IPO price was 22, but that day it went up to 38. And then went down to 20. And then went up to 70-something. You see, you can't even see the scale. There's the scale. Right. Oh, no, where's the... Give me Max. Oh, here it is. It came out, they didn't show the first day, because it came out at 22, but the first sale was at 38. And then quickly fell down below 20, and then, you know, bounced around here 20, and then skyrocketed up to 70, and then back down to 50-something, and now it's at its high point. So, yeah, if you bought that day and then panicked, you lost a lot of money. But if you bought down here, you made a lot of money. What's going to happen? I don't know. You know, I'm the wrong person to talk about it because I can't stand this company. The last thing I want to do when I go home is go on Facebook and look at what people are doing with their cats or their food or whatever. But people are supposedly hooked on this damn thing. I have a Facebook account only because I don't want somebody to steal Wonder Professor. So if you go to my Facebook account, it says, I do not use Facebook. Don't try to friend me. Send me an email via wonderprofessor.com. And I had 39 friend requests until I finally turned off the emails they kept sending me. You have 39 friend requests. I don't care. I don't want to know about them. One was my ex-girlfriend. But she's married. Okay, so what do you want to do with Facebook? You want to buy it? You want to sell it? You think it's too high? You could sell it short. Okay. Anyway, so now we have 10 minutes. How are we doing for time? Not bad. We probably won't get to slide 83. I apologize. But that's okay. Let's see if we can get to some of these guys. You know what does a really good description of all these is Peter Lynch in his book called One Up on Wall Street. And so I'm going to do the Reader's Digest version. Many people, and I think you guys are understanding this more and more, they look at stocks and they think they're all the same. And that is so untrue. I mean, we saw Caterpillar, we saw First Solar, and we saw Facebook, and all those three companies are very different. there are certain categories, there are more than just these, but there are certain categories that we can identify. And that's part of your assignment. In the Chapter 5 assignment, you're going to look up all these different things on Yahoo or CNBC or MarketWatch or whichever one you, Bloomberg. And then at the very last column, you're going to say, this is a blue chip, or this is a defensive company, or this is a cyclical company. And the problem is sometimes there are more than one. And sometimes they don't fit in any of them. Sometimes some companies don't fit in any category. So it's really hard. Sometimes many people consider GE its own category into itself. And I shouldn't use that one because we're going to use that right here. But some companies, you know, they're super the others. But blue chip companies are the biggest, the financially strong companies. They have their roots deep in the economy. Sometimes people use the term value, but you got to be careful there, and we'll take a look at that. They attract conservative stock investors. Now, we're not talking about politics here, folks. We're talking about people who want to invest in stocks, yes, but don't want to see that roller coaster ride we saw with Facebook. They want to see Coca-Cola or GM. Well, not GM now. GM. I got GM, right? So General Electric. So who are the blue chips of the world, folks? Coca-Cola, Johnson & Johnson, ExxonMobil, General Electric. Well, General Electric was one of the bluest of the blue chip stocks. You know, many people considered it in a category of itself until the 2008 crisis came. And most of us think of General Electric as an industrial company. Well, you know, power plants and lighting and electrical and jet engines. But by 2007, they were making far more money off of financials. They have an insurance company. They have a leasing company. They have a credit company. They're making more money off their financials. And we know what happened in 2008. The financial companies all went into the porcelain oasis. And GE was in trouble. And they had a near-death experience and came out with it. But the help of Warren Buffett, who bought $5 billion worth of their shares. Very smart man at the low. And General Motors, at one time, was the largest corporation in the world. And they went through bankruptcy. But they're coming back. Are they coming back? You think GM's going to stick around?
Yep.
I don't know. Okay. Now, by the way, anybody remember why they're called blue chips? You know why they're called blue chips? Okay. Yeah, because of gambling. Before the 1910s or 1920s, the only people who owned stock were gentlemen, the aristocracies. You know, the hoi polloi didn't own stock. And you like that term, hoi polloi? Yeah. The masses, and gentlemen gambled. It's what a gentleman did. It's just something that a gentleman did. And at the gambling tables, the blue chips were the most expensive chips, and that's where the name came from. Right? You like that? You're not impressed. I think it's pretty good. I like trivia. After class, I'll ask you a real good trivia question that you can beat people up with. All right, now, the next category are income stocks. Income stocks are traditionally stocks that are in slow growth industries. Again, you will sometimes hear people refer to them as value. They typically pay very high dividends vis-a-vis or relative to the market as a whole. And the archetypal, the poster child, if you will, are utilities. Are utilities exploding on the upside? Unless the area is growing that they're in is growing. In the 1950s, SDG&E was a growth company because San Diego was growing at 20-30% a year. There was a new. Right now, we take it for granted, but then it was, oh my God, there's a whole new city over here, a whole new city over there, a whole new city over there. But for the most part, utilities grow very slowly. And so they can pay out much of their dividends. They don't need to take that earnings and plow it back into the company. Banks used to be considered income stocks until they started playing fast and loose with the money, our money, and then losing our money. And hopefully someday in the future they will go back to being boring old banks. Don't hold your breath. Questions, thoughts? Now, The next category are the stars, folks. The growth stocks. The ones with the gorgeous hair and the beautiful teeth and they got the pecs, right? Showing off their muscles. These are stocks that experience high rates of growth in operations and earnings. The growth rate, 15 to 20% or higher, often associated with high PEs. Often associated, as we saw, you saw Farsbook, right? What was its PE? 70-something, yeah. So growth stocks have a high PE in anticipation of the growth of earnings. Most of the profits, though, are being reinvested back into the company. The stock price should go up, but it's going to be very, very volatile. And so let's take a look at some examples. Intel, wait a minute. Are Intel, Microsoft, and HP, are they growth stocks anymore? No. 20 years ago, when very few people had a PC and the internet was, you know, finally starting up, it was 20 years ago that what was it called? I can't remember the name of it. Not Netflix. Netscape! Thank you! Netscape went public. And you don't even know what Netscape is, do you, some of you? And that's when they were the growth stocks. Now they've become blue chips, income-oriented stocks. Because how many damn times does Microsoft have to rewrite Word? Every time they do, they make it worse. Windows, every time. Have you played with Windows 7 or 8? 7, I guess, is kind of okay, but 8? And you know what? They're not going to come out with 9. It's going to go from 8 to 10. Figure that one out. I don't know why. You ask them. But it's horrible. It's absolutely horrible. There's no way I am buying another Windows machine. I'll buy XP machines for $50 off of somebody who doesn't want it anymore. But I will never buy another Windows new machine. Yes?
They go with technology, not with their hardware.
They don't care. They just, whatever they can get people to buy. And they have 27 different flavors of it. Right? So you buy this one, the 12th one, and that doesn't work, they get you to buy the 13th. And then that doesn't work, you get to buy the 14th. Keep upgrading. Keep paying us another $100. It'll eventually work. Eventually. So who are the growth stocks now? Farsbook, Titter, Tesla. Victor wants to buy GoBroke, right? What's it called?
GoPro.
I'm sorry, you're not GoBroke. GoBroke. Okay, so when we come back, we'll continue with this. We'll review, and we'll continue with the industry's loose usage of the terms growth and value. So you get an education? If you want to stick around and watch Mr. Rothenberg discuss 2015, I'll put that on. If not, come up, see me. If you have questions, work. Work on Chapter 4, work on Chapter 5. Turn in your assignments even if they're late. See you on Tuesday. Who came in late?
Oh, yeah.